Yeah. Rifles go down at 4:59 and kegs of beer came out at 5:01.
That's right.
That was how they did it in the field back then.
It was very different. We had, like, for my first annual training with the attack helicopter battalion, that was the deal. They had coolers full of beer. There were these crazy guys that made a tennis ball launcher gun out of lighter fluid and cans. It was just kind of wild. It was just kind of wild and crazy. And so I watched the guard really transform from the Claymore guy with hair down to the middle of his back to this kind of crazy annual training with beer coolers, and then really transition into becoming the professional force that we've become.
I'm Joe Seemandel, and this is Raven Conversations. And today I'm joined by a very special guest. If you have ever spent a day in the Washington National Guard, probably in the last, I would say, dozen years, yeah. You served under Major General Brett Dougherty, who is the Adjutant General. He is here to join us to talk about what he's been doing since retirement. He retired in the end of June of 2024. His time as Adjutant General, kind of revisit some of that, and then really just some advice for future guardsmen and those they're in the force that are newer. So thanks for coming on, sir. We appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. First thing I'll do is just wish everybody a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year and Happy Holiday to everybody. It's great I'm here, and there aren't a ton of people at work. It's not a beehive of activity. There's no disaster, and it's great that people are able to spend some time with their families, and just encourage everybody to remember that. When you got a good slack time, take advantage of that.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that. Yeah. So I know it's 44 years in service.
Yeah.
Intro and background on yourself is going to be very long, but as little or as much as you want to share, sir.
Okay, well, I'm a fifth-generation Washingtonian. I used to be able to come back and compare notes with Governor Inslee on that all the time. He was also a fifth generation Washingtonian, but I was born in Tacoma General Hospital and grew up in Federal Way and went through the whole public school system there, a little time in Catholic school there as well, and just kind of grew up in the 60s and 70s in Federal Way. It wasn't really much to it. We weren't even incorporated, played a lot of football and baseball and ran track in school and that type of thing, and had a really good childhood, I guess, growing up here in Washington. So I was outdoors all the time, loved the state, loved the people. Anyway, wound up going to Seattle University on an Army ROTC scholarship and coming out of that program as a second lieutenant in the regular Army. And you know, I joked about the fact that I had a four-year obligation of service, and I said it must have been the carbon paper that slit back there, because I ended up doing a total of 44 years, which is something that was never, ever in my game plan as a young man. But had a great career and really, really enjoyed it. Spent 9 years in the regular Army, and then gosh, I guess a 30 plus in the Guard. I'd have to do the math to add that up to make it all work out. But it was a great time, and wound up retiring here in 2024, and spent 12 years as TAG and the 3 years before that as A TAG. And so 15 years down there at the end of Building 1, and saw a lot of things happen down there.
Yeah. You joke, the paper must have slipped. So same thing, right? I signed up thinking it was a 6 year and I was going to get out after six. And here I am 24 years later, still sitting here in uniform.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of fun. And I mean, it's not easy and there are some hard times, but there's some good times as well. And the people that you get to work with, and I've really come to appreciate this even more now that I'm retired and kind of back out there in the civilian part of the world. The people that you work with here and at Camp Murray and throughout the Washington Guard and the military department, we're just really good, special kind of people. And really quality folks work here. And so if you do work here, you're in a pretty good spot.
Yeah. So I always like to ask this question for anybody that comes on. How'd you learn about the Guard? I think we all have an interesting and unique Guard story of the day. We're like, hey, what's this National Guard thing?
Well, I guess I have kind of two stories to tell there. So the first one was in 1976. Well, actually, three stories. So the first one, the very first one, I would have been about 5 or 6 years old, hanging upside down from a tree out over Military Road near my house. And there was always a convoy of trucks and jeeps that were headed up that road to the Nike missile base in Kent. And I remember hanging upside down, looking out the tree, waving at the soldiers and stuff as they went by, thinking, that looks pretty cool. I might like to do that sometime. And so I guess that was really the first time I ever saw the guard. It was the convoys going up to the Nike missile base, and I was just a little kid. Then in 1976, I was an ROTC cadet, and we came down to Fort Lewis for a field training exercise, and we went out to observe the 81st Brigade, and they were a mechanized brigade at the time. And this was post-Vietnam, so we'd been out of Vietnam for only 3 years, so it was still kind of that whole crazy era of time. And I'll never forget this. We went to the Claymore Range, and there was a guy with a steel pot, and he had hair clear down to the middle of his back.
And it was a different guard.
It was an incredibly different guard. And he hits the clacker, and boom, the Claymore goes off, and we all thought that was cool. And he turns around, he looks at us, and he goes, cool. And that just stuck in my mind, like, oh, my God, what is going on with this organization? And so I wound up going into the regular Army, and I kind of just forgot about the guard at that point. And I was headed down the road to be a career regular Army guy, and I came back to the state as a ROTC assistant professor of military science, and they realized I was a hometown kid, so they put me on the general's pet project of recruiting. And so I was what was called a gold miner, and so I had to travel to every high school in the state 2 times a year and every community college 2 times a year and put on presentations and talk to people. And I was doing that. I kind of became aware of some things going on with the guard, and I was an Army aviator, and I'd been flying really old Cobra attack helicopters at Fort Hood. They still had, like, you know, the bullet hole patches in them from Vietnam, and they were old. I mean, they were just old dogs. And I come down here, and I was down at ROTC headquarters one day, and as I drive past the airfield, I look over, and I see all these fully modernized Cobras, brand new, right off the assembly line. I'm going, God, who owns those things? And I find out it's the Washington National Guard. So I said, those guys have got some really cool-looking helicopters over there, much better than the ones I was flying. And so anyhow, one thing led to another, and I could see the Cold War coming to an end, and I could see the active Army going to shrink dramatically. And I'd been away from troops for 4 years, you know, doing recruiting. Man, this is probably a pretty good time to make the move if I'm going to do it. So anyway, it was that exposure to our Cobra outfit that convinced me that, hey, the Guard has changed. They've got top-line equipment. They must have some top-line people over there flying those things. And so that's what spurred me to come over across the street and look into the Guard. And like I said, 35 years later or whatever it is, it was the right move for me.
Yeah. Yeah, we had Chief Gordon on a couple weeks ago, and we kind of joked about the Guard being different when first got in the Guard, too. And it was the rifles go down at 4:59 and kegs of beer came out at 5:01.
That's right.
It was how they did it in the field back then.
It was very different. We had, like, for my first annual training with the attack helicopter battalion, that was the deal. They had coolers full of beer. There were these crazy guys that made a tennis ball launcher gun out of lighter fluid and cans. it was just kind of wild. It was just kind of wild and crazy. And so I watched the Guard really transform from the Claymore guy with hair down to the middle of his back to this kind of crazy annual training with beer coolers, and then really transition into becoming the professional force that we've become. And I was so glad to be a part of that. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was a pretty sharp regular Army guy, and I'd been to all the right schools and everything, and I was glad that I had the ability to kind of bring some of that expertise with me and help and be part of that transition to professionalizing the force. And I found that really rewarding.
Yeah. So you mentioned 15 years in the front office between being the assistant adjutant general and the adjutant general. Did you ever expect to stay in those kind of roles for like that length of time?
No, absolutely not. General Tony, God rest him, was the ATAG there for, I think, 7 years. And he was really worn out, and I interacted with him every day, and I could see how worn out he was, and I thought, man, there's no way I'm going to stick around and do this forever, you know. But one thing just kind of leads to another, not only do you have to think about yourself, you have to think about who's coming behind you, and who is going to lead the next generation, and you really have to think about that. If you're only in it for yourself, yeah, come and you do your 2 or 3 years and go retire and that's it. But that's never who I was. I've always been very concerned about the team, and so I always tried to do what was right for the team. And this situation, the right thing for the team was to stick around until we could get the next, you know, generation in place with the right experiences and education and training that they could take the baton and do great with it.
Yeah. So I kind of pulled some of the highlights over your 12 years as tag.
Okay.
One that I think is important to touch on, since we're kind of going through another transformation now from strikers to infantry.
Yeah.
Infantry squad vehicle, I believe is what it's called.
Okay.
Transformation from tanks to strikers. You played an instrumental part in making that happen, from not just the, you know, pushing to NGB saying, hey, I think we can become a striker brigade in Washington,
right,
but actually making it happen.
Yeah, that was probably one of my greatest accomplishments. Not me personally. That was a team accomplishment, and I always stress that with the guys from the 81st. I mean, I was a former armor officer. I mean, that's how I went into the Army, was in tanks, and I love tanks and armor. But I watched deployments, and I watched the 81st twice park all their big, beautiful tanks and Bradleys and get into Humvees and MRAPs and do what they did downrange, and I thought... Meanwhile, I'm looking across the street, and the guys at JBLM, they're in strikers. They deploy as a striker unit. They stay together as a striker unit. They come back even more proficient than when they left. Whereas our poor guys, when they got back, well, guess what? Now the tanks have been modernized, and new systems have been fielded, and they were behind the power curve. So they had to start over again and really get back into being a heavy brigade, and they were at a disadvantage. And it just struck me that, you know, maybe we got to be following the lead of what the active Army was doing. We're at the Striker Center of Excellence, for crying out loud. Why don't we pursue that? And I was mulling all that over. And then one day, a few of the senior guys from the 81st kind of came through my door and closed it and said, look, sir, we need to talk. This isn't getting it for us. We really need to look at strikers. And I said, well, we're on the same page. I'm thinking of the same thing. And that was an uphill battle. It took me 7 years of talking directly with General Odierno, the Army Chief of Staff, who hated us, talking with the Secretary of the Army, who backed up General Odierno and wasn't interested in it. I worked with General Brown, the First Corps Commander at the time, who loved us and was a very fair person and helped us every way that he could. But it just getting over that bureaucratic change was really, really difficult. And in the end, we owe it all to the Russians. The Russians started acting up in Europe, and there was a need for heavy armor. And so I was serving in the Pentagon at the time on this committee of Guard general officers, Reserve general officers, and active component general officers. And the Secretary of the Army was there. And so I thanked him publicly in this meeting that we were at for supporting the transformation of the 81st to strikers. And he said, well, that was an elegant solution to a problem that we faced. And he went on to explain that they really needed our armor set to counteract what the Russians were up against. And that seems like a million years ago. And I mean, the whole nature of warfare has changed since then. But but that's finally what put us over the hump, was that they wanted to do that.
Yeah, I think not just the transformation, but then the modernization from... Because you'd mentioned when you first got in the Guard, there were Cobras, and we've changed over the years to now a Black Hawk and Chinook platform. But for a very long time, we had some of the oldest helicopters in the Army.
We did.
And you were able to help get us now on a track to more modern aircraft.
Yep, that was another big push. That was about another 7 years. But in fact, we did have the oldest Chinook in the Army. It's in a museum now because of that. There's a picture of it in action in Afghanistan. On the wall there as you go through the halls of the Pentagon. But it had seen a lot of action in Vietnam. It was the oldest one in the entire Army. And our crew chiefs and mechanics over there at AASF number one are miracle workers, and they took so much pride in that old helicopter, and they kept it flying and in good shape and able to go perform missions. But it was obvious to me that we needed to modernize. Our Blackhawks were old, and so my daughter deployed to Iraq, and she was flying new Mike models, and the unit that came in behind her was a National Guard unit that was flying the old Alpha models that we had, and the guardsmen couldn't even keep up with them flying over the area doing their left seat, right seat, local area orientation flight. And if you're going to send forces into harm's way, then they need to have the best equipment possible. And so I was just really, really after that. And it took a long time, a lot of politics, a lot of help from our senators, our CODEL. But what put us over the edge there was that fortunately, our Blackhawk unit was part of a California higher headquarters, and they had a really powerful congressional delegation. And so the Washington and California combined CODEL was able to pull us through that, and took a lot of trips to D.C. But again, that was the right thing to do for the right reasons.
Yeah, and you mentioned the helicopters in the museum. It's actually at the Museum of Flight, Boeing Field.
That's right.
You can see it right there on the outdoor display. We did a run a few years ago, and you actually run through and right by the helicopter. It's kind of a cool thing to see sitting there. So
that's awesome. I have not been there since that has been added to the collection. I'll have to get up there.
Another highlight I pulled, you really emphasized the state emergency, operations, the state, anytime there was an activation at the state level.
Oh, yeah.
During your time as Ed in general, you dealt with some of the most, I would say, insane things, right? The Oso landslide.
Yeah, terrible.
9 of your years as TAG, we deployed to wildfires.
Yeah.
The COVID response.
Right.
Numerous floods, snowstorms. Pick a thing that kind of happened, and you really emphasized also the Cascadia subduction zone.
Yeah.
Potential, disaster that could happen there. So really, when you look at all of that, you kind of looked at it from a, hey, these are things that this is a Guard mission. This is a staple of the Guard.
It definitely is. And so I'll relay a little story. It actually comes from General Barlow via General Loewenberg to me. And, we've got the Minuteman statue out here in front of Building 1. And General Barlow told General Loewenberg, if you notice what direction that guy is looking, he's looking to the south. He's not looking across the street. And he says there's a reason for that. And the reason is that we're not looking across the street at the active component because we work for the governor. The governor is our commander in chief, and that statue is looking south for guidance from the governor. And so that statue should just kind of be a daily reminder of who we work for. Now, it's a different story. When we get called up and mobilized, then we make that shift. And I led the first group of Washington Guardsmen that were called up to Title 10 shortly after 9/11. And that's what I told them. I was just a young lieutenant colonel. And I said, we have now crossed the Rubicon, and we need to tighten up because we're in a different environment now. And we're part of the active duty force again. And that's how we need to conduct ourselves. And mm-hmm. So it's different. We just have to get used to transitioning back and forth between those roles. But when we are at rest, when we are in state and not deploying, then we certainly have to follow the lead of our commander in chief.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I did not know about the statue.
Yeah, the statue.
I look at that statue every day when I come to work.
I always thought that was a pretty cool story. Yeah.
Another one I put on here, State Partnership Program.
Right.
During your time, you really emphasized the partnerships in Indo-Pacific. We're able to secure a second partnership with Malaysia.
Right.
How does that end up happening? How does that? I remember part of the paperwork process, but from your standpoint, how did that happen?
Well, it's like everything else that we, once we set our mind to getting it, we kind of use the same process each time, and that is you apply for it, you fill out the paperwork. But we as a team with all the colonels and the directors of different of our departments here within the military department, we sat down and we kind of talked about what it is that we wanted to accomplish when I first became TAG. And so I pulled everybody together, said, okay, we got to get out of our silos. We got Air Guard doing only Air Guard stuff. We got Army Guard trying to be be both a response force and we're totally focused on overseas deployments. We got emergency management just kind of off on their own. Nobody really talks to them too much. And I said, we got to break down all those silos because we need all of us functioning together. And so that's really how we got started in that. And it became evident to me that we had been so focused on, you know, the war fight, and rightfully so. We deployed well over 10,000 troops into the Middle East by that time. But our domestic skills had kind of atrophied. And as a young major, I had to build a binder for aviation, you know, on how to contingency plan for everything. And it was kept in the jock, and everybody had these binders, and they were ready to go. And while everybody was deployed, somebody just threw that stuff away. I still cringe to this day thinking of all the man hours it spent, you know. So I said, look, we gotta take a pause and get back into the domestic game here. We're still going to continue our war fight, of course, but for those who aren't deployed, we are well overdue for something bad happening to us here domestically. And so that was the focus point. I could just see that with any luck, we were going to start drawing down our overseas commitments. That war had already drug on for a very long time. And we needed to refocus on getting ready for domestic ops. And so, but we were going to do it together. We weren't going to do these siloed things. We were going to work with emergency management. We were going to have Air Guard and Army Guard jointly responding. And I built all of that, not just on my own. That was a team effort with all the senior leaders of the organization at the time. And so when we came out of those meetings, we came out of one mind of this is what we want to do. And so one of those things was to try to expand our partnership program. And so we applied for it. And then the lobbying began. I mean, I was on the phone with the director of the joint staff and with the chief of the Guard Bureau and the J5, you know, asking them how our application was looking. And all the staff, they were pushing it hard with their counterparts. And in the end, there really wasn't any argument because we're right next door to Thailand. And economically, you can do a lot of twofers. You can mm-hmm. you can go to Thailand and then just hop down, hit Malaysia, and you can do a lot of activity there. And what I really hoped also is we could do some multilateral work with both Malaysia and Thailand. And we got a little bit of that in there, but that's an area probably still for future growth.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was great to be able to do that and get that program up and running.
Yeah, the 2-hour flight from Kuala Lumpur to Bangkok is much better than doing two yeah. multiple, you know,
and you know, I had this argument with the guys over the years. It was like, hey, you know, sir, we really need to get something in Europe too. And I'm going, okay. I said, in fact, I told a couple of guys, I'm retiring, but if that's what you want to do, you know, more power to you, buddy. But I can tell you, getting on that plane and flying, you know, all the way around the world twice in, yeah. you know, two different directions, that is going to wear everybody out.
Yeah. This is probably one of those questions you're like, not a clue. How many trips between Thailand and Malaysia did you take during your time as adjutant general?
Oh, my God. There was a bunch. More than a dozen for sure. I mean, it was a bunch. At a minimum, I tried to go once a year. And that got kind of cobbed up a little bit because we had a coup in mm-hmm. Thailand and the State Department shut us down yep. for a while. And we lost a lot of ground during those couple of years where we were kind of shut out. And it was a dumb way to respond to that coup. And we pushed back, but we couldn't break through D.C. to let us do that. But when I was able to get in there one time, and I wound up having dinner with the commanding general of the Thai Air Force's Air College, the Air War College, and I took that as an opportunity to talk with him about the coup, you know, and mm-hmm. what the heck's that all about. And I've come to learn much more about it since then. But at that time, my point was, why are you doing this? And he was like, we don't trust our people to make the right decisions in their votes. And so I whipped out a little Thomas Jefferson on him and said, you know, here's something Jefferson said, was if you don't trust your people to make the right decision, then the solution is not to take that power away from them, but is to educate them so that they can make an informed decision. And you got to trust. And And those are the kind of conversations that we can have as senior leaders with our Thai and Malaysian counterparts that are so important, that will never happen anywhere else. And you establish a rapport and a trust with those guys, and you can really have some deep discussions. And that's really what the program is all about. I mean, it's a shoestring budget. We're not a huge military presence. It's really about those relationships and having those deep conversations.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I felt pretty good about getting that program up and running with Malaysia as well. And the General Welsh and the ATAGs and staff are just doing a great job keeping all that up and going. And especially on the Air Guard side of things with Enduring Partners, my God, that's a major accomplishment for the entire United States, not just our program.
Yeah.
So anyway, I hope we can get more of that going. And I know I talked with General Sellers about getting more Army presence in there, and I know he's focused on that as well.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, as a school teacher, the Washington Youth Challenge Academy has a place in your heart.
It does.
So during your time as Adjutant General, roughly 2,500 graduated from that program.
Right.
Talk about that program, what it means to you, what it meant to General Loewenberg, who helped stand it up, and really as it's kind of continued to move forward.
Well, I've always been just exceptionally proud of that program, and I think it reflects the Washington Military Department, the Washington National Guard in particular, at our best. I mean, we're not doing this really to recruit from. I mean, we might get one or two kids a year out of that program. It's just not a big recruit generating program for us. But what it is us being responsible members of our community, responsible citizens of our state, and trying to assist young people that have got so much potential to get back on the right track and then go forward to lead productive lives as hardworking taxpaying citizens of Washington. And I always found that. Even as a teacher, you can see kids that come into your classroom, and you know that there are some that are just not going to make it. They've got rough situations at home or a host of other problems that are impeding them from really learning to the maximum and making a successful life for themselves. And the Youth Challenge Program really addresses that and gives kids the opportunity to work hard. They got to do the work. And to get back on track and then go forward and have successful lives. So I ran a nonprofit for a few years in between the Army and becoming a teacher, and we did a program similar to that, but we didn't have nearly the resources to do an in-resident full-time program. And I think what the Youth Challenge Program does is just really commendable. And I've been concerned with all the, the budget cuts with DOGE and all that. I thought for sure that program was going to get cut, and I'm very thankful that it has not and is continuing forward.
So. Yeah, I think we just recently had our 4,000th graduate.
Awesome.
Through that program.
That's
so
great.
So, sir, I, being a former school teacher, I just mentioned that. I came up with some pop quiz questions.
Oh, awesome.
Here, and the audience can play along. Hopefully they
yeah,
know
oh,
the
yeah,
answers.
Yeah, yeah. Get out your tag so, trivia questions.
So the first question, and I think adjutant generals have a pretty good knowledge of the past of the adjutant general. Is the 35th adjutant general of the state.
There's 36 was me, right?
You were number 30. Oh, so yeah. You were 36. General Welsh was 37.
Yeah.
There were only 35 before you at this point in history. It's a very small group of people. So you were one of six who spent more than a decade as the adjutant general.
Wow.
So can you name three of the other five?
Yeah, I can do that one because I knew a couple of those guys pretty well. Clearly General Loewenberg before me and General Barlow. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Maurice Thompson, everybody knows that he served forever. Over the course of a couple of different wars. And then there was General McGee, who also served, I think, for, 13 years. And then the fifth one was the building's named after Hero Brian.
Yeah.
So
So I wrote down the notes. Yeah. General O'Brien was 1883 to 1895. He saw the guard through his statehood.
Yeah.
Into Washington statehood. Yeah. You mentioned Thompson.
I think he gave me my oath, if I remember right. Yeah.
Thompson was multiple times. He served his tag three times, actually.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give you the total because that's the next question.
Oh, but, okay.
His longest tenure as a tag was 1920 to 1941.
Yeah.
So 21 straight years as adjutant general. Now, could you imagine 21 straight years in that seat?
No, I cannot. I can only hope that back in those years, they were not, suffering from the same amount of emergencies that we seem to have during my tenure.
General McGee, 1965 to 1978, was in the Guard during Cold War, Vietnam. General Barlow, 89 to 99.
Right.
General Loewenberg, 99 to 2012.
Yeah.
And then you from there to 2024.
Yep, that's right.
So mentioned already the 21 years for Thompson. He served his tag three times. How many years in total do you believe he served his
tag? Well, I think if we added it all up, it's going to be right around 27, Joe.
Yep, 27.
Add that up. Yeah.
So this is a non-tag question.
I hope so.
This is a non-tag question. But as a school teacher, there's a little bit of math involved here.
Oh, no. I was a history guy. Come on. Give me a break.
So according to your bio, you flew more than 1,300 hours amongst five helicopters.
Yep.
But you also taught school.
I did.
For quite a while as well. So in Washington, the average school day is about 6.22 hours a day.
Okay.
And it's 179 days a year for the school year.
Okay.
So do you think it was longer one school year or the amount of time you flew helicopters?
Well, I can tell you when I was teaching, it definitely seemed longer.
And I'm pretty sure I said that multiple times. That's going to be your answer.
I love teaching, but... The biggest misnomer there is when you talk about a 6-hour day. I used to do 12-hour days when I was teaching. If you're going to do it right, you got to really be dedicated to it. And I would come in early and do intramural hockey with the kids, and then I would teach all day, and then I would get ready for the next day, and then I'd go coach.
Yep.
And then after that, on at least once a week, I was changing into my flight suit in the locker room and heading down to Fort Lewis to strap on an aircraft. So I made very, very long days.
Yeah.
I guess if I 1,300 hours, I'm going to say it was probably longer for a school day.
No, the flying, actually.
Oh, the flying.
Just a little bit.
Well,
but
good.
To your point, it wasn't just a 6-hour day. You were there 12 hours each day. And luckily, we have one of your former students here as our JAG.
Oh, yeah, Brian. Yeah.
Brian Chinchar.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. He was a great, great long distance runner, Brian Chinchar. Yeah.
So you are a history guy. And I think you may get this question. You're also a tank guy, so I hope you get this question.
Oh, man, I hope so. No pressure.
So you served 44 years in total in uniform.
Right.
Definitely not the longest of anybody's career, though.
No.
Who is credited as the longest serving member in U.S. Army history?
The longest serving? Let's see. You know, I think I'm going to go with General Patton.
Oh, so close.
So close? Is it MacArthur?
Bradley.
Bradley. Oh, dang it. Okay.
Bonus points. Do you want to know how many years he served?
Okay, sure. How many?
70 years.
Yeah, that guy's crazy.
Officially 1915, he commissioned and he died serving in 1981. But if you count his 4 years at West Point, he served 70 total years.
That is amazing. In fact, I remember when he passed away. He passed away 1 year after I was commissioned. So we actually served 1 year together. That's amazing.
That's amazing to think. Like,
I can't imagine that. 44 versus 70. No, no thanks, man.
Yeah.
I'm good.
So this one has nothing to do with serving in the military, but you're a Seattle University graduate.
Okay.
In 2024, you were honored by your alma mater, Seattle University, with Community Service Award.
Right.
Do you know the 2-time back-to-back Cy Young winner and current Detroit Tiger pitcher who is also honored in 2024 by Seattle University?
No.
So on the website, the only reason I thought about this is on the website, your photos are right next to each other.
Oh, my God.
Tarek Skubal, he came out to Seattle during the playoffs and pitched against the Mariners.
Oh, my God. That's awesome.
That was a huge story during baseball season.
I did not know that. Yeah, well, I'm kind of a on-again, off-again baseball fan. You know, I was on this year. I got to see a couple of Mariners games and followed them all the way through the playoffs, and I think they're going to do fantastic next year. I'm really excited for that.
Yeah.
But
yeah, so yeah. You kind of mentioned post service and what you're up to.
Oh, sure.
And retirement, and you already kind of mentioned going to some Mariner games. What else have you been up to?
Oh, I've been up to a lot of things. I'm really kind of surprised at how busy I have been. There's this strange thing that happens when you get ready to retire. You start thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, I'm just going to be going crazy sitting around the house without anything to do. I'm going to be so bored. And it just doesn't happen that way. I mean, you have to consciously, you know, try to become bored. You just got to stop yourself from sitting on the couch, you know. Otherwise, you can. You can just sit there and watch, you know, the news channels all day long and go crazy. Or you can get up and go do something. And so I've been trying to be really active. And I'm doing everything I said I was going to do before I left. And that is spending a lot more time with family. So our daughter lives in Kansas City. I just got back yesterday. Dolores and I flew out there and had Thanksgiving and spent a couple of weeks with her. And fortunately, my son and his family were able to drive up to Kansas City from Colorado Springs. And so we had the whole family together. And that's pretty typical. We're doing probably, I don't know, three or four of those kind of, you know, family get-togethers per year. The kids all come up here in the summertime. We hang out at the cabin up above Lake Chelan and get out on the lake in the boat and fish and swim and do those kind of things. So spending a lot of family time. My mom and dad are still with us. They're both in their 90s. My dad's going to turn 93 here next week. And so we're spending a lot of good time with them and enjoying that. And then Dolores and I traveled to Saipan during the winter months. They got the Patriot Express, which is a space-A flight. Doesn't cost you anything but your lunch money to get on that plane and fly all the way to Guam. And we have a little house there on the island of Saipan. And so we stay there for about a month or two and get to hang out with Dolores' side of the family. And that's something that ever since I became tag, we really couldn't spend much time doing. So we're doing that, doing a lot of hunting, a lot of fishing. I'm out fishing out of Nia Bay for halibut and lingcod and sea bass, and did pretty well up there last year. Just was getting with my neighbor last night planning this next season's trips. Then hunting, I spent both my 66th birthday and my 67th birthday humping an elk out of the woods on my back, which is a great problem to have. So we've been able to be successful out there hunting and having a good time doing that. And then we're excited this year. We're going to be on Saipan for a while, and then we're actually catching a flight over to Australia, and we're going on a cruise kind of all around New Zealand and Tasmania and out to the Great Barrier Reef. And so I'm trying to do, you know, a Saipan trip and then some other kind of adventure travel at least once a year. And just last night we were on the phone with the family and we're talking about maybe going to Vietnam for Christmas next year. And my daughter-in-law's parents grew up in South Vietnam as kids before they escaped to get out of there before the communists took over. And they go back quite frequently to see family. So we're going to tag along with them and have another family experience in Vietnam. And I'm looking forward to that. So do that. And then I do some volunteer work. Not too much. Chief Almond twisted my arm and got me to volunteer to serve on her board, the Serve Washington board. So that's AmeriCorps. And then she leaned on me a little bit more, and I recruited Robert Azell and Dan Dent to join us as board members. So I'm doing some of that stuff for AmeriCorps and Serve Washington. And I'm also on a startup. I'm on a board for another group called Patriots for Education, formerly known as Troops to Teachers. And so we're trying to crank that program back up again and find a path for people leaving the military to become teachers or anything else within the school system that they may want to do. So that little bit of volunteer work there keeps me pretty active and thinking about things other than, you know, how to tie the next fishing knot. And so I enjoy that and I feel like I'm still participating in a positive way. And I'm also trying to still, I'm kind of on hold right now, but I'm working with Washington Guard Association. We're trying to basically get our memorial walk squared away. And Jim Perrin has been doing great work identifying all the people who served and who unfortunately, you know, died in action during all of our conflicts. And so we want to get stone or bronze tablets at each of those bench sites out there to memorialize those guys. And it's just super expensive to, but we hope to at least get one statue put up out there to kind of memorialize everybody. But I'm on hold right now, NGAW, working with some other National Guard alum at the Secretary of State's office. They've got to get legislation passed to increase the amount of money that can be used for things like that, that the Secretary of State's office could manage for us. And so I'm hopeful after this next session of the legislature, we can get back into trying to do some fundraising around that. And you know, it's been 150 plus years, and we haven't memorialized anybody. You know, we've got a few things out at the front gate, and I think there's one rock out there that was done just by one or two people. And but the organization is just, we've always been so busy and so broke, we've never memorialized people properly. So I'm still enthused about doing that and hope to get into that next year.
And you still have time to do the honeydew and to-do list at home.
Yeah, that list is pretty darn long, and it grows every day. And, you know, so I've had these cabins up in the woods above Lake Chelan for 40 plus years, I guess, and we built them ourselves, but now they're aging out, you know. So now there's a ton of maintenance I got to do on those things, and we got this little house on Saipan, which all sounds great, but you know, we got typhoons that come through there, so we got to do maintenance on that building. And my home is not a new house, and so yeah, I have no trouble coming up with lots of projects that Dolores knows that we need to get done.
I was going to ask if you're doing any kind of, like, I would say speaking engagements. You've always been such a fantastic speaker, great kind of motivational speaker, real knowledgeable on things.
No, I really haven't. I did one up at Whidbey Island. I went up there, and they had a military association of one type or another meeting up there, and I spoke with them. That was shortly after I retired. I was still pretty fresh on stuff. They kind of wanted to know what the National Guard did and what they were up to. But other than that, no, I haven't been approached, and I'm not out there, you know, beating the bushes trying to get speaking engagements. I don't need any. I'm good.
We can use this part kind of as a speaking engagement piece. So I always like to. One question I always have is, so not a lot of people have been adjutant generals.
Yeah.
How does that experience of being both a state and federal leader in an organization, how does that really, like, that's a daily stressor? It's got to be.
Oh, it is. Yeah. The job of being an adjutant general, especially in turbulent times like we're in right now, it is really tough, because as everybody knows, we kind of have two bosses. We have two chains of command. We've got our federal chain of command, and we've got our state chain of command, and we change statuses back and forth. When both our federal chain of command and our state chain of command are on the same page, it's not too bad. But when those two different organizations are really kind of diametrically opposed to each other, the adjutant general is the one who is stuck right in the middle between federal pressures and state pressures. And so you've really got to be careful in how you navigate, and you really need to understand who you're working for at the particular time, and what's your responsibility to your two chains of command, and how do you balance all that when they're kind of diametrically opposed. And it's a very stressful situation, and my hat's off to General Welsh. I think he's just doing a superb job right now of navigating those shark infested waters, because I saw over my career tags get fired and replaced every month, I mean, across the country. And it is so easy just to, with good intentions, make a mistake in those treacherous waters and sink yourself. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's a stressful job, but it's also incredibly rewarding. I could not wait to get to work in the morning, and would usually stay here a little longer than necessary. because I was just so proud of this organization and this team, and so committed to the important missions that we do here, defending the country, protecting our state, trying to help kids that are struggling get back on track. I mean, those are three huge, really good missions. And yeah. So, it is a stressful position, but it's also exceptionally rewarding. And one thing I would tell people out there is if, you don't think, well, I'd never be an adjutant general. I don't know anybody in Olympia, or I don't know a congressman. Well, neither did I. And I had no idea that I would ever have an opportunity to serve in that position. It just kind of happened. And so don't rule that out. Always try to conduct yourself now like you might be in that position someday, because you just don't know. You just got to be prepared at all times. You don't know what's coming down the pike.
Yeah, it kind of leads into my last question. Is I even myself kind of look in the mirror every once in a while and I say, how am I now the guy in charge of all these people, or how am I at this point in my career above rank wise all these people? And I try to impart as much advice and guidance and wisdom as I can. And I always look to folks like you. Hmm. So any kind of guidance, advice that you got for that next generation of leaders coming up in the Guard?
Well, for the next generation, I would just say thank you for first of all, even being in a position to think about this. Very few people in our state, in our country, are doing the types of work that we do here and serving in the ways that people serve here. And so thank you for what you're doing. It's really important, and I'm so glad that the next generation is there and in strength too. It seems like our recruiting woes have been solved here, at least at the last word I got. So thanks for being here. As far as advice, I would just say what I used to tell everybody when I was tagging, and that is be a soldier or an airman or a civilian according to the golden rule. If we would just remember that and treat other people as we would want to be treated ourselves, to be kind to other people, to try to lift people up, to be slow to anger and quick to forgive, and give people the benefit of the doubt, especially people here on our own team. It's so easy to get angry at somebody at work and then, split the team up and keep the team together, and just realize that not every place has got a team like this, and you are so much better off here with this team than somewhere else. But commit to it and be kind to each other. Build the team. Don't tear it down. So that's one thing. Just live according to the golden rule if you can. And the other thing is to be prepared for anything, because anything can and will happen. I mean, I never thought that we would have the most deadliest landslide in the country's history. I never thought that we would go through repeated worst fire seasons in state history. I certainly never thought that we would have a global pandemic. Never thought that we would have the largest civil unrest period twice over two different issues during my tenure. But those things all happened. And while we were doing all of that, we were still deploying units overseas. So you really have to be prepared for anything. And that takes it takes positive action. You can't just sit in a chair and think about, gosh, what would we do? You really need to develop an organizational structure that is flexible enough to deal with those crises when they come up. You need to have some contingency plans that you can kind of fill in the blanks when things happen, so you're not starting from scratch. You need to build the relationships with all the different players in the state and communities, so that if we do have to roll in either with emergency management or the Guard, it's not the first time you've met those people. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of work that goes into truly being prepared. And I'm glad you brought up the Cascadia Subduction Zone earthquake, because I want to talk just a little bit about that. This one still gives me nightmares, because we are not ready. And it gave me nightmares when I first became the Adjutant General, because I knew we weren't ready. And we tried mightily to get our state prepared, and we made some progress. But we are just flat out not ready for that big earthquake. And we probably won't be ready until the ground shakes. But we've got to continue to make progress, to build the plans, to make sure that our communities are prepared to evacuate along the coast. We need to think of everything that we can do now that will result in saving lives when that day comes, because it is coming. And every year that passes, we're closer to that earthquake occurring. So my advice is, if you're in the National Guard, just understand that you're going to be busy. If you're in emergency management, understand that you're going to be busy, and try to do as much as you can now to prepare for all those contingencies, because the chances are they're going to happen.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. So I don't think I could ask any other questions that would give us a better answer than that, and I think that's a great spot for this.
Okay, all right.
To end. So I appreciate you coming on.
All right.
If you like the video, give it a like. If you want to know more, throw a question in the comments. We'll try to get them to General Daugherty. He still answers emails pretty regularly, which I do. I always appreciate.
Yeah.
So if you like the video and want to watch more, subscribe for future videos. And sir, I appreciate
all right,
you coming
Joe.
On again.
Great to be here. Take care, everybody out there. Have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, Happy Holiday season, and spend time with your families. Very important.